So today we change topic and we talk about locality in quantum many body physics. One of the goals of this topic is to prove, or at least give a sketch of the proof of the Lieb-Mathis-Schütz theorem. Which says that connected correlation functions decay exponentially, the distance between A and B, if there is a gap and the ground state is unique. So this is one of the goals that we want to reach. So this theorem has been known for a very long time, but it was proven in its whole generality, meaning in an arbitrary dimension, very recently, in 2006, by Matthew Hastings. And that the fact that for correlation functions should decay when you have a gap has been known for maybe 60 years or more. But only until Lieb and others proved it, it was a folk theorem. And the final proof was given just in 2006. So this is to show you that the things that you are covering now are extremely modern. But in general, locality in quantum many-body physics plays a very important role, as we shall see. So we want to start with a question. So our setting, we're using ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, right? Which is not the right theory. It's non-relativistic, right? We know that relativity is true. So it's just an approximation. So what happens in non-relativistic quantum mechanics is that there is no light cone. And what does it mean that there is no light cone? What happens when there is a light cone? What does a light cone tell you? Yes, so the light cone tells you, I'm repeating because it's recorded. The light cone tells you that events that are an event that is outside of the light cone of another event cannot be causally connected to it. But in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, there is no light cone. So this means that, in principle, arbitrarily far apart events can be causally connected, causally connected. And this is bad. In fact, we should question whether we should use at all non-relativistic quantum mechanics for many body problems. So it would be very inconvenient if you can send a signal by applying a small local perturbation on one end of a spin chain, and immediately, at every small t, you can see the effect of this perturbation on the other end of the chain. But this could be, in principle, measured, right? So because that cannot happen, then who knows how many other bad things, you know, are implied by this that we are overlooking. Okay, so then there is a second question. What about correlations that are far apart? So correlations are subtler, right? So correlation does not imply causation. So even in a relativistic theory, you may have non-vanishing correlations, because that does not imply that we have sent a signal. So we don't know what happened. Correlation, something weaker. And again, but here we don't have a light cone. So well, we have only two possibilities. One is to give up and say, okay, no, the real theory is quantum field theory, the relativistic theory. So let's trash everything we know about spin systems and quantum many body physics. Or we are so lucky that there is a guy called Elliot Leeb who proved a beautiful, amazingly beautiful theorem together with Robinson that is called the Leeb-Robinson bounds. And this theorem that I will prove today says that if your quantum many body system is local, so the Hamiltonian is the sum of the local operators, even if we didn't impose the Lorentz symmetry, there is a light cone. There is always an emergent light cone. So a piece of the relativistic structure emerges without having put it in the first place, solely from the fact that we started with a local theory. I think this theorem was proven in the 76 or something like that, and nobody noticed it. It finished in some communications or mathematical physics. Nobody noticed it at all. And basically, it was rediscovered by Matthew Hastings, that used it to prove the Leib-Mathis-Schütz theorem in general. And then since then, people became very fond of this theorem and did many improvements, and they use it a lot to prove new things. It's a very beautiful theorem. So let's start. Okay, so a local system. So we want to focus on what a spin system. And I will tell you at the end why we want a spin system, not a general system. Okay, so we start with a graph. So we know that the graph is a set of vertices and a set of edges. And the set of edges is just a subset of the power set of the vertices. The power set meaning all the possible powers of lambda times lambda times lambda times lambda. Okay. And we have a notion of distance between two points. That is the graph distance. And to every vertex in our graph, we associate a local Hilbert space, H of X, and we require that this local Hilbert space is finite dimension. So this first requirement already points you to the fact that we have something that is like a spin system in which, so not necessarily spin half, but every local system has a discrete finite number of levels. Okay. And the total Hilbert space associated to our graph is the tensor product of all of them. All right, then you also remember that we have to put some condition on the Hamiltonian. So let me consider the set of subsets of lambda that have a diameter smaller than a certain number r. So such that the diameter of X, which by definition is the max over all the X, Y in X of D, X, Y, smaller than R. Okay? So every time I use this symbol, I have in mind a situation like this. This is a patch on my lattice such that the diameter of X is smaller than R. It's R at most. Okay. And then you remember that we want the Hamiltonian to be the sum of operators that have support on things like this. So we define what is called an interaction map. Such that we get an X from this set, and we associate phi with the support on X. So this is the support. And phi is linear bounded operators. Okay. So the operators are bounded. Well, and the support H of X is, of course, what? It's just the tensor product of all the local Hilbert spaces in this patch X. Right? So at R local Hamiltonian, as the form H equal the sum over X of phi X. Okay. So in order to complete the definition of what is a spin system, oh, God. In order to complete this definition, we have to add one more thing. We want to say that these operators that we define on our Hilbert space, including the ones in the interaction map, are so-called bosonic operators. So we are involved only with bosonic operators. So all these operators, phi x, phi y, that are in the interaction map, or other operators that we want to use in the theory, must be bosonic. By bosonic, I mean that phi x phi y is zero if x and y have a null intersection, or which is the same if the distance, the graph distance between x and y is greater than zero. Okay, so if they don't overlap, then these objects have disjoint support, and that being bosonic operators means that they commute when they have disjoint support. So not every operator is like that. Fermionic operators are not like that. They anti-commute at distance. Okay? So they are inherently non-local. So they're not very suited to speak precisely of locality. We want to be very sure to be in a setting where we know what is where, and when things are not touching each other, they commute. So commuting means basically, so we'll see it, I think, tomorrow, that we cannot influence what happens in Y with what happens in X. So we will see it clearly, but you already have an intuition of that, because commutation means that no measurement made on X has an effect on measurements made on Y. So it's almost like that. It's measurements. We will see that we can show that it also implies that you cannot send any type of signal whatsoever. Okay. So now imagine that we have some operator A that is as a support . So my operator A has a support on a region A of the lattice. Yep. Yes.
And that's defined as the minimum of the distance
between all the points in one set and the other set. Sorry? Oh no. Okay. So I'm using the set of X's. X's are subsets of lambda. I'm only considering those sets of X that have a diameter smaller than R. Okay? So this is a subset of lambda. Scattered points are a subset of lambda. And then there are those subsets of lambda that are in a ball of diameter R, and I call, every time I use the letter capital X, I mean one of these. Okay. So. Okay. So if you want, chi R is the set of all the x's such that, okay? So I'm always picking x's in chi R. Okay. So imagine now that I have an operator A with a support in A, and another operator B, and also A and B are local, according to the same definition. They just do not need to be operators that are in the interaction map. They can be anything. But with the local supports, that is disjoint. Okay? So obviously, AB commute. Right? We just said that. So far, so good. Now imagine that now we look at the time evolution of our system. We do not look at some specific state, but we look at the time evolution. Okay, so all the operators evolve in the Heisenberg representation. So in particular, A of t will evolve in this way. You agree? I think it's like this. Okay. So imagine that we are in some state. So if we compute the expectation value of this thing is zero. Because the commutator is zero. But then we perturb the Hamiltonian a little bit, and the system starts evolving. So now we have the commutator between A of t and B. What is the support of A of t? Right, but the Hamiltonian being like that. So it's the sum over all the possible patches on lambda, although they are local patches. But when you exponentiate it, this is an operator, even when you don't exponentiate, but it's an operator on the whole Hilbert space. So the support of A of t is the whole Hilbert space. For every t, no matter how small. So this object is different from zero, no matter how small is t, and no matter how distant A and B are. There is no light cone, right?
When you write your Hamiltonian like this, you're summing over all possible subsets of the Hilbert space that are smaller than is it clear that it just covers the whole Hilbert space? I mean, that I can, the union of all of those sections gives me the whole Hilbert space?
Yeah.
For every arc. Right?
Yeah, for every given arc. Yeah. So, for example, just to clarify, in the Ising model, our interaction map phi of x is minus jg sum over I sigma x I for when x is equal I. Huh? Without the sum. Thank you. And minus j sigma z I sigma z j when x is ij and zero otherwise. So this map that to every patch associates something mostly is zero. It specifies what is on which patch. Okay. Okay, so let's go back to our dramatic easy result. At every small t, no matter how distant A and B are, the influence of A will be felt on B. So how do you even dream of thinking that there is an emergent light cone? So to see that this is at least possible, let's try to think in perturbation theory, okay? So imagine I do perturbation theory on this operator. At the zero order, A has a diameter that is R, right? So if B is at a distance greater than zero, than the commute. After the first order in perturbation theory, A will be decorated by other bubbles that are these phi x that are in here that have diameter r. So after the first step, I can not commute with A with B if B is at a distance that is not greater than zero, but R. At the second step, I can reach up to R squared. So, of course, because we have to do the whole development, then at the N step, I can cover a distance that is this N times R, and the support is everywhere. But, so imagine that now this is at the distance NR. This means that we need the N order in perturbation theory. So the strength of the interaction at the N order is epsilon to the N, where epsilon is the small parameter that defines our perturbation. So it's exponentially small. So it is true that this is different from zero, but how different from zero it is? Maybe it goes down very fast. So this is what Lieber Robinson tried to prove, to put a bound on this quantity. And because this is an operator, the only way to bound it is to bound the norm of this thing. Okay. Well, you could do other things. You could bound the absolute value, the expectation value on some states. But this is the strongest thing that you can do. If you bound the norm, there is nothing else that can be bigger. So this is smaller than what? Okay. So now we understand that this thing can be small if we are far enough in perturbation theory. And OK, now let's see. Now it's the theory. OK, so let me call this object, let me call it f of t. Call it f of t just because I have to write it many, many times. Yeah.
How do you see that in each order you're just spreading out by one more factor of r from a to
the just develop this in power series, in Taylor series. So the first order, this is the sum of the Hamiltonian. Zero order is the identity. They have the sum of the, then it's the sum, then it's the Hamiltonian. So it's the sum of the phi of x. Then at the second order is h squared, right? So it's the sum of the phi of x times phi of x prime. OK. So how do we do that? Let's take the derivative of this object. So the derivative of this object is a prime of t commutator b. Because this is what depends on time. And we use the, we know how operator, what is the evolution equation for a prime of t. So this is a of t h b, right? So do you agree that h is also equal to h of t? Is it obvious to you? So h commutes with this, right? So if it commutes, then h, this is just what I wrote, that h is equal to ut h u dagger. And this is h of t. So now that I have t inside both, I can just pull u out. I have u dagger t, u t, where, let me write it. our evolution operator. Okay? So now let's use the fact that our Hamiltonian is local. So this is equal to minus I, the sum over all the x's of ut a phi on x u dagger t b. So far so good. Now let's look at this phi x. Okay? So when x is here, it has to commute with A. Right? Because they have disjoint support. We use our main rule. When things are disjoint, they commute. The only terms that don't send this piece to zero, which means everything to zero, are those terms that are near A. Okay, so let me define Z1, the set of x's in lambda, such that, so let me call them x1, such that x1 intersect A is non-null. So it is not guaranteed that if an operator is in here, then it will not commute. But for sure, if it's not in here, they will commute and everything will be zero. So I can just replace this sum with the sum of the x1s in Z1. You agree? Oh dear. So once I've realized that, I can pull these unitary operators back inside the commutator. So that is A of t and phi x of t. Okay? So you do it. And then we have the commutator of a commutator. And we can use the Jacobi identity. So applying the Jacobi identity, I would have A of t b commutator with phi x1 minus phi x1 b commutator A. And as I do all these things, there could be any number of sign errors, and I'm not even trying to fix them, because in the end we take the norm. Okay? So we take the norm and we use the triangular inequality. So the I, the signs don't matter. Okay, but now notice this. So this was F prime, right? But what is this? This is F. And this is some other linear operator. This also depends on G of t. So this equation has the form phi prime is equal to some linear operator, that is the commutator with these objects, acting on F plus G of t. So these are linear operators. So this is a linear differential equation of the first order. It's very easy to solve. It's very easy to solve if you are able to diagonalize your operators, which when they're big, it's not possible. But we don't care. Yeah. Yes, yes. I pull back the UOTs inside the commutator. So both A and phi x1 are functions of T, okay? And then I apply the Jacobi identity. Okay. So imagine that I first solve the homogeneous equation when g of t is equal to 0. So it means basically means to find a map, gamma of t, which is a unitary map, such that at f of 0 associates gamma t f of 0, that is my solution f of t. Okay? So this is formally the solution of the homogeneous equation. I don't need to know what it is. I mean, if I want to know what it is, I need to diagonalize this operator, which may be non-trivial. But I don't care. What I care is that this operator is Hermitian, and then the solution is the exponentiation of this operator formally, which is unitary. So if gamma is unitary, it means that it is norm preserving. Or in other words, that the norm of f of t, which is just the norm of gamma t f0, is the norm of f of 0. When I evolve something with a unitary operator, the norm doesn't change. This is the essence of unitarity. Okay, so the full solution, so you know that the full solution then f of t, I have gamma of t on what? On f of 0, plus I have to integrate this term. All right, okay, so this is just calculus. And now let's play with our norm. Okay, so we want to bound this object. And this is smaller than, okay, now we use the fact that this thing is norm preserving. So every time I see a gamma, I just don't care. So this is, and then I use my triangular inequality. So it's the norm of this plus the norm of this. But then I can pull the norm inside this sum, inside this integral, and furtherly bound. Okay, so do you agree with this bound? But what is f of 0? It's just the commutator between a and b, which is 2 norm of a, norm of b. And what is this? So let's read it out. This is the sum over the x1 of this object, phi x1 b. There is S here, because I'm integrating in S. And then I have a 2A. Do you agree? So GS is the commutator, is this commutator with A. Right? So this is bounded by the to the norm of A, the norm of this. They might have disjoint support or not. Oh, okay. So when they have is zero. So in full generality, for any A, B, they are what they are.
What allows you to move the norm inside of the integral?
Yeah, but then I keep bounding from above. That's the triangular inequality, right?
What's it's infinite dimension? Is it Parseval's inequality or something? It's
Yeah, it's yeah. So the sum of the norms is greater than the norm of the sum. Just that. Okay. So we are at this point, right? Now I can. The norm of A of S is the norm of A because, again, this is a unitary evolved operator. So I can pull out 2 times the norm of A. Oh, let me write. To the norm of A, the norm of fx1, there is the sum here. Ah, I already wrote it. B in the S. Okay, do you agree? Very good. All right, okay. So I would like, so you see, now we have the problem of bounding this commutator. Let me call it F1. But this commutator has the same form of A of T commutator B. So I can apply the same technique. I can apply the same technique, okay? So now I want to, so F1 is the commutator between Fx1, Φx1s, B. Okay, so what is F prime one? Well, if we do the same things, we know this is equal to sum over x's commutator of Fx1 s Fx. B. And there is a minus psi, to be precise. But when we take the norms. Okay, so again, we don't care about the fact that there is the S. We can pretend it's not that. I can pull out these unitary operators, just like before. So I have just a commutator between F, phi x1 and phi x. So now the only times this commutator is alive is when x may intersect x1. So I can just sum over all the x2 in z2, where z2 is the set of all the x2 in lambda such that phi x2, such that x2 intersect x1 is different from 0 given that x1 is in z1. Okay. See, these bubbles start propagating. And then I use my Jacobi identity again, and I will have terms of this type. So I will have phi x2 of s B, which is what, sorry, and plus phi x1 of S B. This is commutator phi x1, and this is commutator phi x2. And this is what I call F1. So I have the same type of differential equation. So I can solve it again exactly in the same way. So F1 will be equal gamma of S that is acting on F1 of 0 plus the integral between 0 and S gamma to the minus 1 S1 in DS1, and here we have this G1 of S1 that is this object. So let's take this piece, this F1, and let's plug it back in here. F1, our solution just like before. So if you do that, you have that the norm of F of t is smaller than 2ab plus 0t, the sum of x1 2a. Okay, now we have to plug F1. So the first term is just the norm of gamma s F10, right? But gamma s is unitary, so it's norm preserving. So just the norm of F10, which means it's just the norm of phi x1 commutator b. And when I take the norm, I don't care if there is an s or a t inside, right? Because it, again, it's norm preserving. Plus, I have the same thing times the integral between now 0 and s, and I also have s x2 of phi x2 b commutator phi x1. And I can put a norm here. I hope you can read there. Okay, so let's play a little bit with the norms. So we can furtherly bound by 2ab plus 2a. And now we have 2 phi x1 b 0t sum over the x1s plus this last object, that is 0t sum over x1 0s 2 norm of phi x1, and finally the norm of phi x2 sum over x2 b. And this is in DS1. Okay, so what happens if I keep going? So if I keep going, so I can iterate this procedure over and over again, right? It's always the same thing. In the end, I have something that has this form. F of t is smaller than 2ab that multiplies 1 plus 2 times phi x1 times 0t sum over x1 plus 2 to the 2 phi x1. Sorry, this one, of course. Plus sum over x1, x2. And now I have this nested integral from 0t and 0s. And here I have also phi x2. And so on and so forth. Then at the third step, I will have three of these objects. OK. So now let me define phi of x as the maximum over all these norms. So it's the maximum interaction strength of over all our bubbles. So this means that I can pull it out from the sum. And so my f of t is bounded by this object, that is the sum. Oh, let me. Of 2 to the n phi x to the n. Then I have all these objects. And then I have all these objects. These are just integrals that are not integrating anything anymore because I pulled everything out. OK, so if you remember the Dyson, but they're nested, right? I integrate the first one, then I integrate the second one, the new variable, and so on and so forth. If you remember the Dyson series, this is equal to 1 over n factorial, integrating always n times, always in the same variable t. But then because there is nothing to integrate, this is just t to the n over n factorial. So this is equal to sum over all n from 0 to infinity, 2 to the n, t to the n, n factorial, phi x to the n. And then we have this object. Let me call it sigma n. This is just a number. Now this is a pure number. This was the sum over all the x1s such that. Times the sum over all the x1s such that. So in the end, I have the sum over many objects. Each of these objects is a set of operators that overlap and connect and, you know, and go from A to somewhere at the end step.
You're missing there the factor of the norm of A and B on that part?
Yes. I forgot. Thank you.
It's a number, but is it finite? I mean, I can always find a finite number of sets.
So for every n, this contains n patches, right? So it contains n r points. Sorry, n sigma points where sigma. If sigma is the maximum volume of x, then each of these paths contains at most sigma n points. At most. OK, so you see that there is an exponential that wants to form here. We just are in trouble with the sigma n, because this has not the form of something to the power n. Let's see what we can do. So this is the number of paths that have length n. Number of interacting paths. But number of an interacting path is a set of elements in the interaction map that overlap with each other. Of length n means there are n of them. Okay. So in the end, we know that if we do not connect this last step with B, the commutator will go to 0. So when the distance between A and B, let me call it D, is greater than the length on the lattice, that is nr. Right? I have n patches, each of one has diameter r. I can at most cover a distance nr. So when this distance is greater than nr, the number of paths that connect A and B must be zero. So I can upper bound this number with any exponential, even a decaying exponential, because this is a number greater than zero. So I can upper bound something that is zero with a number that is greater than zero. But when the distance of A and B is smaller than nr, then there are many paths that connect A and B. So how do I bound this number of paths? Well, a convenient way is to bound it with the number of all the paths of length n, no matter whether they connect A and B or not. So I can bound it by sigma to the n. Right? What, if I do n steps and each of my bubbles contains sigma points at most, how many ways do I have to overlap n of these bubbles? Each of one contains at most sigma points. It's sigma to the n. Right? When I have two, I can overlap them in sigma different ways. And so on and so forth. So I can upper bound with this. And then I can furtherly upper bound with any number that is greater than one. Well, in this case, when this is greater than this, this number is greater than one. So sigma n is upper bounded by this. Always. Because this is always greater than zero, and it's, and when in this case and in this case, this is greater than one, and this is by far much more than the number of paths that contain A and B, because this is the total number of paths of length n. It's already an upper bound to that. Okay, we are almost done. So you see, if I plug this expression for sigma n back into up there, we have f of t is very, very grossly upper bounded, meaning this bound is not very tight. We've done so many approximations, but it's very grossly upper bounded by this thing. So I have 2 to the n, t to the n, phi x to the n. Remember, this is the maximum strength of all the interactions. N factorial. There is my 2ab that I keep forgetting. And then finally, sigma to the n, e to the alpha n r minus d. Oh, finally, we have our exponential. So this is what? Exp of 2t phi x sigma e to the alpha r minus alpha d. Let me put an alpha here. Huh? Okay. Exp of all of this. And this is true for every alpha greater than zero. So it's also true for the alpha greater than zero such that this number has the minimum value. Okay? In that case, alpha is more or less equal to two. You can find it numerically. So this is just a constant that has more or less a value two, it doesn't depend on anything. So now define V something that has the dimensions of a speed as 2 phi sigma e to the alpha r over alpha. And you magically obtain that, so let me write it in its full glory, a of tb is upper bounded by 2ab e to the alpha dt minus d. This is the Lieb-Robinson bounds. Vt defines a light cone. Okay? So this is A. When B is within the light cone of A, this object is much greater than 1, and we do not have any bound to the commutator. Well, it's okay. They are within the light cone. They are allowed to influence each other. But as soon as B is outside the light cone, we know that there is the influence of A of T on B is smaller than a quantity that is exponentially decaying in the distance between B and the light cone. See it here. So our light cone is not sharp, it's fuzzy. And it has an exponential tail outside. It's very fast. It's exponential. And we obtain this without doing anything that has to do with the principle of relativity. It's just a locality. And by the way, this fuzziness comes because we are in the discrete. If we go to the continuum, so if I embed my lattice, so my distance L will be equal to my distance d times my lattice constant a, and my speed v, v bar, will be my original lattice speed time, again times a. Well, then, if I embed it in the continuum, this becomes e to the alpha over a v bar t minus l. And you see that as I shrink A to 0, it becomes sharp. So this is what we learned. Locality implies that there is an emergent light cone with the V that is at most this quantity that depends on the strength of the interactions and the lattice structure because it is in sigma and R. And this is not, this is an upper bound. This means that maybe the real light cone is narrower. Maybe there are the maximum allowed speed of signaling is smaller than this one. But we know it cannot be more than this. Because it's an upper bound. In fact, it is a very gross upper bound. In the proof, you see that we keep taking norms of these objects. Right? We have them everywhere. Right? So that's why we need the spin system. If we had an infinite dimensional system where the local operators, imagine they are harmonic oscillators. And our distraction operators are infinite. They're unbounded. Then everything collapses in this proof. So people I've every now and then people now they try to find a new proof that holds for infinitely dimensional Hilbert spaces in some particular situations. And yeah, we can talk more about that if you want. But so the original proof of Lieber-Robinson is for spin systems and it goes like this. Yeah.
Take the lattice space to zero, you will also have infinitely many ways.
Yeah, very good. So of course, no, so this is a very good point. So of course, when you want to embed this, you have to regularize R. So your range of the interactions must be shorter. So R also depends on A, and actually the proof works if R is e to the minus A. No, no, this is what I'm saying. When you embed this R and this sigma have to be regularized, and then if you do the integration correctly in counting all the paths, you find again this expression that with this form. And these are some, again, some constants that are the way depend on how fast the interactions decay in our lattice. So yeah, to do the embedding correctly, you have to do something less rough than what I did here. Okay, so I'm late again. So tomorrow we see what are the implications in condensed matter of this bond. But you'll learn that, you know, if you have a local Hamiltonian, there is a light cone.